This is Company Cars, the podcast that tries to make sense of the car business. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Company Cars. On this episode, we celebrate 1 year of the podcast. So there was no December episode. Things got a little busy in my non-podcasting life, and so this is the first episode that we are taping after the one-year anniversary of the podcast. So for everybody that's been here since the beginning, thank you for sticking with me. I know podcasts don't always last a really long time, and so I, for one, have been very surprised this podcast has lasted as long as it has and that it's been as well-received as it's been. So on this episode, we're going to finally talk about an elephant in the automotive business and an elephant on this podcast. So over the past year, I've gotten a lot of questions about when am I going to talk about Tesla? Could I please talk about Tesla? Could I please talk about the electric car business? And I've kind of put off this conversation for a while. And with the 1 year anniversary of this podcast, this seemed like a good time to finally start thinking about and talking about Tesla. So this won't be the only Tesla episode, I'm sure, but this episode is designed to be kind of an overview of how Tesla developed from a small California startup into the dominant EV manufacturer. All right, so let's start at the beginning of Tesla Motors. So Tesla was founded in 2003 by two individuals, Martin Eberhardt and Mark Tarpening, and the two of them had this vision that an automaker could also be a technology company. And so this doesn't sound so revolutionary now because we have Google in the car business with Waymo, we have Apple constantly exploring cars, we have automakers trying to reposition themselves as technology companies, but in 2003, this was a really unique insight. And so in 2003, the general view in the world was that car companies were car companies. And although these car companies like GM and Ford and Toyota did a lot of R&D and created a lot of innovation, they were considered totally separate from technology companies like Google or Apple, who focused on software. So Martin and Mark had this vision that they could create this company that sat at the center or the intersection of car companies and technology companies. And so they viewed their company, Tesla Motors, as a company that would be focused around how we can integrate electric motors that would power a car with the software that has to govern these electric motors, along with the battery pack that goes with the motor. So this was a really big insight for 2003, and I think in today's world where we commonly think of car companies as wanting to get into technology, and we think of technology companies wanting to get into the car business, a lot of this crossover between the two businesses can trace its roots to Tesla. And this initial insight by the initial founders of Tesla that we could combine a car company with a technology company. So the other big insight at the outset of Tesla was Martin and Mark's vision that they could use lithium-ion batteries to power an electric motor. So this sounds really pedestrian today, but at the time in 2003, electric cars relied upon less energy-dense nickel metal hydride batteries because automakers were really concerned over the longevity, cost, and durability of lithium-ion batteries in large-scale applications like a car. And so these lithium-ion batteries back then and even today are the primary source of batteries in laptop computers and cell phones. And automakers were generally worried that you couldn't scale up these batteries to a much larger application like a car. But Martin and Mark, their big vision was, why don't we just strap a bunch of lithium-ion batteries together? And we can write software and improve the chemistry of the battery to try and address some of these concerns over longevity, cost, and durability. So this was incredibly revolutionary in 2003 because even leading automakers like GM and Toyota had largely ignored lithium-ion technology because of these concerns. And so they had focused on this less energy-dense but more reliable and more longer-lasting technology of nickel-metal hydride batteries. And so the fun fact here is Toyota at the time chose to use nickel-metal hydride batteries in its hybrids, so including the Prius, the Camry, the Highlander, and now continues to use nickel metal hydride batteries in a large number of its hybrids, although some of its hybrids have transitioned to lithium ion batteries. But in a large number of Toyota products, they're still using nickel metal hydride batteries today, somewhat due to these continuing concerns over longevity, cost, and durability of lithium-ion batteries. And so these two insights that Martin and Mark had were fundamentally revolutionary to the automotive business at the time. I think if you rewind back to 2003, and if you poll kind of the traditional automotive executives at the time, what they thought of Tesla, they would have probably written off Tesla as a crazy science project that didn't have much of a chance of going anywhere. And so what's interesting is the other part of the vision that Martin and Mark had that's not discussed very often is their original plan was to actually take Tesla a very different direction. And so they wanted to be focused over the software, the motor, and the battery. And their plan was to get really good at constructing those three things and then sell that whole module to an automaker to bolt in to their car. So their plan at the time was to be closer to a supplier than the actual OEM themselves. And today, like, most automakers are getting into the EV business themselves and wanting to control the entire EV experience from software to battery to motor to design. But that wasn't the case at the time. And for gasoline cars, it's very common for automakers to buy large chunks of the car, even entire transmissions and engines, from other suppliers. And so they saw themselves fitting into this existing ecosystem where they could have a competitive advantage over other suppliers, but they still had large plans to mostly work with the existing OEMs. And so their focus on this product and the motor, the software, and the battery, this is going to change as the company evolves, but this was a really interesting way that they framed the start of their business. But to prove that their technology and their concept and vision for electric motors, batteries, and the software could work, they needed a proof of concept. And having a proof of concept meant they were going to have to put their technology into a car and showed that it worked. And Martin and Mark's third big insight came from this. And this was also revolutionary for electric cars. And they had this idea that electric vehicles could be better cars than their gasoline counterparts, and they could appeal to car enthusiasts. So they correctly predicted that EV adoption would only occur at a mass scale if EVs could be viewed as cool and high performance and outperforming their gasoline counterparts, which was completely antithesis to EV development at the time. So EVs from other automakers like GM and Ford and Honda and Toyota were mainly science and engineering projects that were slow because they wanted to optimize range, and looked really dorky because they wanted to optimize range and aerodynamics. And it was very hard to make a very attractive looking car that was really fun to drive and still could work within the confines of that battery technology. So the lithium-ion battery technology vision that they had enables this additional vision that they have that EVs could outperform their gas counterparts, and that they needed to produce a car that would outperform equivalent gasoline cars of its day and time if they were ever going to get EVs into the world and to prove that their technology worked. So this third vision is going to be critical in the further development of Tesla, and I think is one of the strongest things that has survived in Tesla since the founding of the company. So to achieve their vision, Martin and Mark needed to raise money, just like any startup founder with a good idea. So shortly after starting Tesla Motors and getting some office space and a couple employees, the two raised their first round of funding. And this first round of funding involved a $6.5 million investment from an individual named Elon Musk, who had recently sold his interest in PayPal, had an interest in electric cars, and had some cash on hand that he could invest. And so with Elon Musk on board, the company was off to the races. And so as Tesla Motors was getting off the ground in the mid-2000s, they were headed a bunch of different directions and trying a bunch of different things to see what would stick. So they knew they needed a proof of concept to prove that their technology worked. And so they needed to create something that they could put their motor in and get it off the ground. But because they were so small, they couldn't necessarily design a car from the ground up. they needed to take an existing car and modify it. And so this is what led to the development of the original Tesla Roadster. And Elon Musk became heavily involved in the development of the Roadster. And the Roadster was a electric sports car based on the Lotus Elise and retrofitted with Tesla's motor and battery pack. So the Lotus Elise was a perfect baseline for Tesla because the car was very small. It was very lightweight so that it could take in the weight of the batteries without making the car too heavy. And Lotus did not design the engine or transmission that went in the gasoline Elise anyway. So Lotus had actually borrowed engines and transmissions from Toyota. And so it was easy to take out the Toyota powertrain and then put in Tesla's electric motors and software. So this was their first project, their first proof of concept, and something very contrarian to electric cars because they chose to create a sports car. And the Tesla Roadster at the time, if I remember correctly, it debuted to really strong reviews, and that electric motor and that instant kind of put your kind of back in the seat feeling that you get when you step on the throttle of any electric car, that really fits nicely with a sports car feel and a sports car aesthetic. And so the Lotus Elise turned out to be a really good car to use as the proof of Tesla's technology. And while they were developing the Roadster and Elon Musk was working on the Roadster, Martin and Mark were also pursuing their other vision of refining the motor, the software, and the battery that they could then license out to other manufacturers. And so Tesla also began working on projects with both Toyota and Mercedes-Benz to license their electric vehicle drivetrains and their batteries for these other automakers' EV projects. So eventually Tesla's battery pack would go into the early 2010s Toyota RAV4 EV. I think it was sold from 2010 to 2014 or 15. And also in the Mercedes-Benz B-Class electric drive, which was sold for a couple of years. And so everybody remembers the Roadster. Very few people remember Toyota and Mercedes-Benz's involvement in Tesla. So kind of in exchange for licensing the technology, at different points in time, Toyota and Mercedes-Benz had equity ownership stakes in Tesla. Eventually, those companies each sold their stakes kind of in the mid-2010s. But they were involved together at the time. So the Roadster comes out, and it's a proof that the concept is working. Tesla has these projects with Toyota and Mercedes-Benz. But the company is now at a crossroads. So the company needs to decide if they're going to pursue developing their own cars, kind of a second-generation Roadster, if you will, or like cars that would go with the Roadster, and or they could double down and continue to work on their partnerships with other automobile manufacturers like Mercedes-Benz and Toyota, and maybe recruit a few more where they could put their electric vehicle drivetrains into these other cars. And Elon, Martin, and Mark had severe disagreement over the direction the company should go, and they had a falling out with each other on where Tesla would go, and Elon Musk won. And so Martin and Mark both left Tesla, the company they had founded, in early 2008, just before the Roadster shipped. And so it might be surprising to find out that Elon Musk wasn't involved with Tesla from day one because he refers to himself as a co-founder, but there's a legal settlement between Elon, Martin, Mark, and two other individuals who were at Tesla very early in its life that allows all five of these people to call themselves a co-founder of the company. And now it's time for a short break. We'll hear from our sponsors and we'll share some information about how to submit a listener question. The Company Cars podcast is sponsored by Rejected Conjectures Incorporated, a division of Integrated Derivatives. If you have a question that you want answered on the show, write us an email at companycarspodcast@gmail.com. And so with Elon Musk and his vision winning out over Martin and Mark's vision to more be a supplier, Tesla set out to develop its next car. And this next car was going to have a very different purpose than the Roadster. So the Roadster's role was primarily to prove that the technology could work. Tesla's next car was going to be the car that put the company on the map. And so it needed to be a car that would be revolutionary and that would be all Tesla. So no more of this, we're going to take our technology and snap it into another car business. Tesla was going to get into the car business and get into things like design, engineering, manufacturing their own cars. And in technology and in life, timing is sometimes everything. And this was true for Tesla as well, where the timing at the time may have looked like a terrible time. But in hindsight, crises present wonderful opportunities if you're able to take advantage of them. And Tesla launched the Roadster kind of in the middle of the global financial crisis of 2008. And as they were starting on their next project to develop their next car, the financial crisis presented a multitude of opportunities. And so first, Tesla took advantage of an Obama administration-supported Department of Energy loan that they were going to use to fund the development of their next product. So these loans from the Department of Energy were set aside to support the development of advanced technology vehicles. So the Obama administration at the time, I think, was thinking hydrogen vehicles, plug-in hybrids, and electric cars. And so Tesla certainly fit that bill, and Tesla applied for a loan and got the money and used that money to develop its next car. So Tesla also took advantage of retrenchment and downsizing by other automakers. So the automobile business was really struggling in 2008, and so GM, Ford, and Chrysler Corporation each had a lot of issues that they were working through, and so part of resolving these issues involved downsizing by the automakers, and General Motors wanted to dispose of a factory that it had in Fremont, California, which happened to just be down the street from Tesla's headquarters in Silicon Valley. And this Fremont, California assembly plant is a pretty famous assembly plant. So there's a great This American Life episode, podcast episode about this Fremont, California assembly plant and how it was actually a Toyota General Motors joint venture plant to build Corollas and other products, and a way for GM to learn something from Toyota or attempt to about how they manufactured cars. But in 2008, GM didn't need this factory anymore. They were kind of in the process of exiting their relationship with Toyota for a few products, and so they were going to close this plant. And this factory was turnkey and had been producing cars for Toyota and GM since the 1980s, and so Tesla was very interested in purchasing this plant, and Tesla paid $42 million for the factory, which was well below the cost of developing a new assembly plant and building one for themselves. And this $42 million purchase by Tesla would turn out to be the bargain of the century in terms of deals, because GM just really needed the cash. They didn't want to be in the San Francisco Bay Area from an assembly perspective because the costs were really high to be in Fremont, California, and they had no need for the plant anymore because the plant had already served its purpose in terms of learning about how Toyota manufactured vehicles. So everybody won, but I think the big winner in this transaction was Tesla, and it just shows that timing is everything in the car business. And so this next car that Tesla was going to develop was going to be critical for the company, because up until this point, many people in the car business did not take Tesla seriously and didn't think they would survive very long. And some of this even persisted after this car came out, but nobody was really taking Tesla seriously. And Elon Musk and his team had decided that the next car they were going to produce was also going to be this high-end performance car, but instead of a two-seater convertible, which the Roadster was, they were going to produce a luxury performance sedan, and the idea was they were going to make a car that was similar to a Mercedes S-Class, BMW 7 Series, or Audi A8, but electric. So they were going to go after the top-of-the-line flagship luxury cars, and they wanted to continue to outperform its competitors and just happen to be electric. So for aerodynamic and engineering reasons, they decided to make this really sleek, fastback-looking car, which they later called the Model S. And the inspiration for this car was similar to the stylish Mercedes-Benz CLS class, which was a four-door coupe. So it was a four-door sedan, but with a really aggressively sloped roofline to make it look really beautiful. Or similar would be an Audi A7 as well. So these two cars, the A7 and the CLS class, were both known as really high-end, attractive, beautiful designs at the time. And so Tesla decided that, okay, we're going to build a car that can outperform kind of the more traditional S-Class, 7-Series type cars, but we're going to make it look just as good as kind of these ultra-stylish alternatives that existed in kind of the high-end luxury performance car segment. And the other critical thing is they needed a car that would outperform the gas cars. And that included not just kind of straight line acceleration, handling, braking, but also range. I think Tesla realized at the time that they may not be able to match the gasoline cars on range, but they could get really close. And they were able to develop the Model S to offer up to 208 miles of range at its launch, which was more than twice the amount of the next longest range EV, which at the time was the Nissan Leaf, and offered about 110 miles of range. And so 200-mile range was a big deal because it really put the car in the conversation of this could replace a gasoline car and not merely be an addition to a gasoline car. And the other thing that the Model S was known for was its design. So in addition to offering 200 miles of range and performance that was comparable or better than kind of a full-size luxury car, the design of the Model S was quite revolutionary at the time. So the exterior was pretty traditional. I mean, it looked good, but it didn't blaze any new trails. But the interior was absolutely gorgeous. So inside, Tesla pioneered the use of just one large vertical screen, kind of iPad-like in its shape, that controlled all aspects of the car. And this was incredibly revolutionary at the time. I think now a lot more cars offer kind of this one screen controls everything idea. But at the time, most cars had a lot of buttons. Like if you go back to 2012 and you look at a Mercedes S-Class or a BMW 7 Series from that era, it's got a lot of buttons on the board. And so Tesla created this really sleek screen with no buttons. And so when the car's turned off, it just looks like a piece of furniture inside. So the lead designer for the car, a man by the name of Franz von Holzhausen, said that he drew inspiration for the Model S from the Mercedes-Benz CLS class, and that the interior was just going to be this like revolutionary clean sheet look for the car. And Franz von Holzhausen is a pretty pedigree designer. So he had come to Tesla from Mazda, where a company that's known for its pretty attractive designs. And he had also worked at GM and Volkswagen. And so his previous work included the Saturn Sky and Pontiac Solstice twins at GM. And he was part of the design team that worked on the revolutionary at the time, 1998 Volkswagen New Beetle. And so when, this car, this Model S, Tesla and Elon Musk and his team were swinging for the fences. This car looked good. This car drove incredibly well. This car had a gorgeous interior and was so futuristic. And so this car was, in all essences, a no-compromises car and surprised everybody. So when this car came on the market in 2012, the reviewers loved this car. And so Consumer Reports called the Model S the best car it had ever tested. Not just the best electric car, but the best car, period. And this car and Elon Musk and his team swinging for the fences here in all dimensions of its design and engineering ended up being the right strategy for the company. So this car won all sorts of awards. This car was Motor Trend Car of the Year. This car was a Car and Driver 10 Best, I believe. And it was the it car to own. So if you were in LA, San Francisco, and New York, you wanted to have a Tesla Model S. In 2012, the Tesla Model S was revolutionary, and I think that's the point that I was trying to make. And by making a car so revolutionary, Tesla did a fantastic job making this car, and by extension, electric cars, cool. And so as the Model S is rolling out and gaining popularity, Elon Musk and the team at Tesla noticed that there was one key issue with electric cars, even for ones that offered 200 miles of range like the Model S. And that was, there's still this lingering concern over range and where you could charge. Because if you had a gasoline car, you could stop into a bunch of different gas stations across the country. But if you had an electric car, you were kind of tethered to wherever you plugged in at night. And so the team came to the conclusion that if Tesla could build a national charging network and provide owners of the cars easy access to charging, no matter where they're driving in the country, they could really alleviate these concerns over charging and kind of further move electric cars from being a secondary car or a toy car into people's primary cars. And so this was a revolutionary insight at the time that electric vehicle adoption was tied in with the rollout of a national charging network. So most automakers at the time who were thinking about electric cars saw the charging issue and then just kind of left it alone at that. And so Tesla deserves a lot of credit for trying to address the charging issue. So they began to build this network of charging stations called the Supercharger Network, which we all know now, which was designed for the exclusive use of Tesla owners. So this was designed to get you to buy a Tesla and would be great marketing material when Tesla people were trying to sell a Tesla. The idea that only Tesla owners can use this charging network, and that's still largely true to this day, although this might be changing in the future, so stay tuned for updates and developments on that as it progresses. And the Supercharger network is still a leading competitive advantage for Tesla. So they have, I think, one of the largest, if not the largest, networks of charging for electric vehicles. And Tesla cars use a in the U.S. at least, use a proprietary plug. And so you can't take that plug from a Tesla and plug it into a regular charging station, like say from Electrify America or EVgo or ChargePoint. You need an adapter to plug in to those other stations. And likewise, if you have like a Chevy Bolt, you can't plug into a supercharger network currently, although that might change. So this was a really nice way to bring people into the Tesla ecosystem, kind of like how Apple for a very long time had a proprietary lightning plug for its products. And so this was a competitive advantage for Tesla. So they sold supercharger access with the Model S, and this was a marketing revolution in a way where you would bundle charging with the car. And at the time, this was so foreign to electric cars because like the Nissan Leaf, Nissan did not bundle fast charging with the car. I mean, they gave you a cable, they gave you contact information for companies to come and install a charger at your home, but they didn't really, Nissan didn't do very much to address fast charging. And so bundling fast charging on or charging on the go access with the car was huge. And other automakers have started to copy the concept by contracting with EV charging networks and providing X amount of free charging to new EV owners. So that was a bit of a marketing revolution for Tesla there. And the Supercharger network combined with the Model S kind of really put Tesla on the map and showed people that they were serious about sticking around. And over the next few years, Tesla kind of starts to flesh out its lineup. So they add the Model X, which is an SUV version of the Model S. And Elon Musk, never shy of a challenge, embarked on another large challenge, which was to bring an electric car to the mass market. So the Model S and the Roadster were kind of these high-end luxury cars, and so Tesla wanted to sell this kind of much more mainstream car, and they kind of came out and said, we're going to sell this car that has like 200 miles of range for $35,000, and they called it the Tesla Model 3, and this car was Tesla's most daunting project, because not only did this car face engineering challenges to try to get to the $35,000 price point that Elon Musk had said publicly, they also had to ramp up production at volumes that were several multiples of Model S and Model X. And so Tesla put essentially the entire company behind Model 3 production, design, and engineering, and launched the car in late 2017. But the company, there are some press reports dating back to around that time where Elon Musk confessed that if the Model 3 had not worked out, the company probably would have gone under. So the Model 3 ended up becoming the most important car for the company, and I think it's still a large percentage of the company's sales today. But they ended up not really offering a $35,000 version, despite the car being very successful. And so they offered a $35,000 version very briefly in 2019, and then they discontinued it. But the Model 3 served its purpose of bringing electric cars and Tesla closer to the mainstream. So it allowed Tesla to move further down market. It allowed Tesla to bring electric cars to a new segment, kind of this compact luxury car segment. And in many global markets, it's the best-selling electric car. And so Tesla is here. I think anybody that says Tesla is about to implode is probably not right, in my opinion. I mean, that doesn't mean Tesla may not struggle over the next few years as other automakers get into the electric vehicle space. And this is not a financial podcast, and so I'm not going to opine on the stock price or the stock movement. And also for disclosure, I don't own any Tesla stock, nor do I intend to acquire any Tesla stock. But I think the Model 3 and eventually later the Model Y, kind of the SUV version of the Model 3, I think with the arrival of those two products, Tesla is probably here to stay. Like, they're probably going to be around for a while. The company seems to have this critical mass of manufacturing, design, and engineering. And even though they certainly have some things that the company needs to work on, I think they're going to be around. And I think what's unique about Tesla and how they're the electric vehicle leader is, I think, a couple things. One, Tesla has benefited substantially from being first. So sometimes it pays to be first, and it pays to have developed the technology first. So certainly they don't have a monopoly on software, electric motors, or lithium-ion batteries. But because they were the first to start working on it, they kind of have this lead on their competitors, including at VW, GM, Ford, etc. And Tesla products generally have more range and higher performance than competing products, you know, kind of competing EVs. I think that's starting to change a little bit with this newest group of electric vehicle startups. But for now, they still have more range than most competing products. And this is a market where shoppers really care about range. So that makes a huge difference. And I think this is reflected in Tesla's continued back order, even though some of the back order that's out there today is due to supply chain issues. But I mean, some of it is also probably due to consumer interest in the products. And we didn't talk about this very much in this episode. We'll explore it, hopefully, in a future episode. But there's also a large number of shoppers who find Tesla's retail sales model to be really refreshing. So Tesla is also very revolutionary in that they do not sell their cars through dealerships. They sell their cars directly to the consumer. And so you kind of go to Tesla.com, you click around, and then a car shows up. And there's no negotiations, the price is the price, and everything is very transparent in terms of accessories and financing. I mean, certainly there's still an element of salesmanship, so there are stories out there where if you try to order a certain car, and they'll call you and they'll try to convince you to take a different car. But in general, most Tesla buyers find the shopping process for a Tesla much more refreshing than buying a car at a traditional dealership and working with the salesman and shopping many different cars. So that's another big revolution that Tesla's been able to push through that no other automaker has been able to push through, and we can take that in a different episode. But their retail sales model is also very revolutionary and refreshing. And I think also Tesla's decision to start with luxury products and then work down to mainstream products was also good for its branding. So Tesla was able to brand itself as this premium, luxury, trendy brand that people want to own. And that was huge in getting adoption. I mean, brands spend a long time trying to get themselves to be front of mind to the types of consumers that they want, whether that's younger buyers, more affluent buyers, buyers who set trends in, you know, think shoppers in San Francisco, Austin, Los Angeles, New York, and DC. And so Tesla was able to do something that a lot of other automakers have struggled with over the past two decades, especially in the luxury segment, and I'm thinking of Cadillac and Lincoln, and that is to brand itself as a premium, cool product that people desired. And even today, even though Tesla continues its march down into the mainstream, many view Tesla as this cool company that makes really cool products that's well ahead of other EV companies. And so I think Tesla has made a lot of really good decisions in its time, and some of it is also luck, but they have some really strong competitive advantages, and that's probably why we see more Teslas than any other electric vehicle out there on U.S. roads. So in this episode, we've covered some of what led Tesla to where they are, and in a future episode, but maybe not our next episode, we might mix it up a little bit. We can talk about some of the other pieces of Tesla in more detail. So if you have thoughts on particular things you'd want to hear about Tesla, write into the show. We're companycarspodcast@gmail.com. And so we'd love to hear from you. And so thank you for listening to this episode on Tesla. And thank you for sticking with our podcast for a year. We're really happy that we've been able to make it this far. And by we, I mean me, because I'm just one person here podcasting. If you haven't noticed, our end credits characters are have some very interesting names. And so I hope everybody had a wonderful new year, and I hope you continue to enjoy the show as we move forward. And so thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.